This is definitely a privilege to have this opportunity. I was reading a bit about Kristen, and it's very clear when you visit her website and you or you see any of her talks online that she is her life is anything but run-of-the-mill. This is someone who's just a vibrant collage of talent, enthusiasm, generosity, playfulness, and deep commitment. As an award-winning storyteller, she has dedicated her life to building bridges across countries and cultures through one of the most timeless art forms known to humankind. The arc of her life has connected the dots between Allentown, Pennsylvania, the villages of Belize, and stages and classrooms across the rest of the world. And it's a journey that's really required both courage and clarity. Some years ago, Kristen sold her home and most of her possessions to follow her dream of being a full-time storyteller and to found a volunteer literacy outreach program in Belize. Traveling village to village, she's listened and learned from the stories of the people and then sought to keep those stories alive through her work with children and educators. Her donated gifts have now touched over 33,000 children, and she's trained over 800 teachers. Helping stories live forever is an integral part of her job description. And so is blowing bubbles on subway trains in New York and participating in Big Wheels competitions dressed in superhero costume and organizing free hugs events everywhere that can use one, which is pretty much everywhere, including, and this is a true story, the top of Machu Picchu in Peru. Her joyous work also encompasses something called that she calls story solving, the role of stories in tackling difficult subjects like bullying. And I could go on for quite a while more about Kristen's one-of-a-kind story, but I'd much rather we all heard it in her own words, so we'll rein in here and thank Kristen for joining us on this call today. It is such a pleasure to have her with us and to have this opportunity to reconnect through her to the beauty, power, and infinite possibilities that dwell in the stories we tell. And so, Kristen, I'm going to turn it over to you. I think one of the places that might be fun to begin is at the beginning. Tell us where it all began for you, this deep-seated passion for the interplay between stories, theater, and changing the world around us for the better. And feel free to begin with Once Upon a Time.
Okay. Well, Once Upon a Time, as a child who was always the smallest kid in the class and was not athletic at all. I was actually almost legally blind, and they didn't discover that until I was in fourth or fifth grade. So you can imagine being the smallest kid in the class, not really being able to see, on top of being slightly hard of hearing. And stories just became a way to escape in certain ways, and they also became a way to the escaping part was really about learning about a bigger world around me. I was really fortunate that I have a grandmother who taught me how to read when I was 4 years old. And that was such a huge gift, because in reading stories and learning about a world beyond my own backyard, I started to have this incredible and deep love for learning about different cultures starting at a really young age. And that expanded over time. It was always a curiosity I had. And the other piece that my grandmother always instilled in me, not only the power of reading and of story, but also she always encouraged us to really learn about the other person and to understand the other person. And when we see ourselves in the other and the other in ourselves, we're connected. And it's a way of building bridges between us. So she instilled that in me in a really young age. And I hadn't really realized all of those connections until the last couple of years, realizing how huge her impact had been upon me. And then once I got out into the world, I had actually started with studying speech and theater when I was in college. And some of the work we did at that time was Reader's Theater. Mm-hmm. And Reader's Theater was taking literature pieces and transforming them into theatrical pieces. And I was blessed to have two professors who were really interested, again, in speaking about some difficult issues out in the world, One of those professors was Roberta Christen, and the other was Teresa Patrick. And they always chose material that was really compelling. And one piece in particular that still stands out to me was a piece on apartheid. And that was crumbling, which was a wonderful thing. It was things were really changing in South Africa at that time. And we did a piece where half of the members in the cast were African American and the other half were white. And in working together and speaking about that issue and really having incredible heart-to-heart conversations, it's one thing to have a conversation about racism in a group of people who all look the same. It's an entirely different conversation when you're hearing stories from the point of view of someone who's lived some of those experiences and was brave enough and willing enough to share it together. And it just made such a huge impact on me. And then the storytelling, it kind of evolved because I started out doing with this theater background and thinking I had this dream, like I was going to go to New York and I was going to be a Broadway actress. And I never did pursue that. But the storytelling, it kept coming out in different ways. And another way was had a job doing ovarian cancer research at the University of Pennsylvania. And it wasn't microscope research. It was interviewing cancer patients. And we had this incredibly in-depth, detailed medical questionnaire. But what was most telling about it, the most important question was the only open question, which was tell us the story about how you were diagnosed. And it turned out that was the most valuable question in the entire study. And sitting with these women and listening to their stories and having so many of them say to me, you're the first person that asked me, that asked to hear my story, thank you. And how deeply that question touched them, that someone would want to hear their story. And that always stayed with me in a different context of how important a person's real story is. You know, the different folk tales that connect us, the legends that connect us, hold a certain power. And then there's also the incredible power of a personal story from someone and how that fits in and then relating to life events. And after that, I became a children's librarian completely by accident. I lived next door to a library, walked in one night, was just joking around with a friend, reading some books out loud, and the director asked if I'd like to do that as a job. I said, oh, that'd be great. And my schedule was really flexible at the time. And she said, yeah, and we'd pay you to do that. Oh, that'd be wonderful. And she said, and can you start tomorrow? And I could, and I did. And that job evolved into becoming the main children's librarian at the small library in a small town, blue collar town, that three factories had been shut down in the span of 3 years and was economically depressed. And my job was to do a lot of outreach in the community and bring the children into the library.
And was that,
and then
your,
my,
was that
pardon?
Your first time, was that your first time working with children?
No, it wasn't my first time, because when I was in college and after college, I did a lot of children's theater, which was actually grown-ups presenting theater for children. So that was something that was sort of a common thread that was throughout my adult years. But working with them that closely, basically one-on-one, it was the first time doing that sort of work, and I loved it. And one of the goals – oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, like, what kind of things did that kind of, you know, what kind of insights and learnings came from that period? Because I think you did that for 10 years, right?
Almost, yeah. It was almost 10 years. Huge amounts of learning. Some of it really was about truly being in the moment. 3, 4, and 5-year-olds, they are right there. They are completely present. The other thing is they tell you the truth. So if you come into work one day and you did not prepare 100%, they will tell you. And it keeps you, I think it keeps the integrity. Mm-hmm. It keeps you on your toes. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I learned from them was how hungry they were to learn more about the world beyond their backyard. And so the programming, I was really fortunate that I was given complete free rein. And my boss was really open to saying, Kristen, I trust you, and you do whatever you feel is right. in the programming, and I trust your instincts, so go. And that was really great, having such freedom, and meaning that the material that I would choose to share with the children was probably sometimes a little bit beyond what someone else may have done.
Can you give us an example of that?
Yeah, and I'm gonna give you an exact example. One that was probably one of the most powerful books that we did with the junior book club, and this is 10 to 13 year olds, was called Iqbal, Iqbal, and it was a true story. Well, it was historical fiction, so although it was based on true events, the story itself had a lot of fictionalized details added. And it was a young boy in Pakistan who worked in a carpet mill. And he had unfortunately been sold into slavery as a young child. I think he was about 4 years old. And it was to pay for medication for his older sister. He was an incredibly determined child, very driven, incredibly intelligent. And he escaped. Several different occasions he escaped. And on one of those occasions, he saw a group of adults speaking out against these factories that were basically abusing these children. And it was child slavery, really. And he approached them asking if he could speak with them. And they at first sort of scoffed at him, and you're just a child, what could you possibly have to share? And he said, I can tell you firsthand experience what it's really like. And he was so well-spoken and he was so persistent that they allowed him to join. And he spoke out against these factories for 3 years, ended up receiving some international awards for his work. And the reason I shared that story with the children was to show them their own power. The idea that children often have even more power than a grown-up if they stand up and speak their mind, if they write a letter to a person in power, because it's still rather unusual for a child to do that kind of thing. And so often they're heard even more so than an adult would be. And they were encouraged afterwards. We talked about writing letters to people in power about something they were passionate about. And several of the children did, and then reported back over time what happened and how they felt like they were making a difference, that their voice was being heard. And it was just so wonderful to watch them care more about a world beyond their own small town and feel connected to children in different countries. And we did several things like that. There was another book called It's Our World Too, and it was all true stories of different teenagers all over the world who decided to do something about whatever it is they were passionate about, whether it was the environment or helping kids in the neighborhood. There was one teenage boy who collected bikes and repaired them and then gave them to other kids who couldn't afford to buy bikes. And it's just the idea that we all have something we can contribute, mm-hmm. and sometimes we just need someone to pull it out of us.
Well, listening to you, I mean, I'm trying to imagine, you know, you in the library or like the performing of these stories, because I get the feeling it wasn't you just opening a book and reading it out loud.
Oh, no. Gosh,
right.
No.
So can you tell us a little bit about how you brought these stories, kind of breathe life into them for the kids and your other audiences? Like, what's your...
Sure. So the becoming a full-time storyteller grew out of the job at the library. And an example of that is with the younger children. Well, actually, with all ages. I was fortunate having that theater background as well, and such a passion for literature and folk tales, because I'd already done a bunch of research before I even started the job. And then that gave me just a wonderful avenue to wrap all these things together and to connect them. And so, for example, at a story hour, I would never just read the book. There would always be interaction. There would be call and response, things for the audience, the children to do, and the parents too. So it wasn't only about the children and bringing them in. It was really about bringing the parents into the story too. So I'm thinking, like, for example, there was a story one time, I love ducks, And so I was telling a story about ducks. And for the children, we made little cardboard little duck feet. And then we took a little rubber band and put that around the back of the duck foot. And I had all the kids wear the duck feet while we were doing the story. And then we walked around like ducks afterwards. And I dressed as a duck. I'm fortunate that I'm really small. So I bought a children's Halloween costume on clearance of a big duck. And that's what I wore to the story hour. So it was just about always really bringing that theater part into the story too. And also bringing the heart. I think it's really important for any storyteller, no matter what types of stories they're sharing, that they connect deeply to the story with their heart and realize that that story is a gift. A storyteller who's really amazing, Elizabeth Ellis, she blesses all of her stories before she tells them. And I think that's such a beautiful practice, and I've borrowed that from her to really thank the stories and trust that in any given situation, the stories that need to be shared in that moment will somehow come to the forefront of the mind to be shared, to connect.
Wow. You know, one of the things that seems to be like a common thread in many of the timeless stories of our world is like there's often a threshold, you know, that the protagonist cross, a point in time where he or she kind of accepts his destiny and, you know, makes off to whether it's slay a metaphorical dragon or whatever it is. And, you know, I look back at that time, I don't know exactly which year it was, I think maybe 2005, when you decided to really jump off that metaphorical cliff and, you know, pursue your dream of being a full-time storyteller. And I imagine that kind of transition wasn't lightly arrived at. Can you talk a little bit about
sure.
that moment?
It took, it actually took a year to make that decision, a year of thinking a lot about it. And it took a lot of, I used to be a really type A personality, and sometimes I that happens still. I mean, actually probably more often than I want to admit. So I wrote many, many pros and cons lists and oh my gosh, can I really do this? And what am I thinking? I'm newly divorced and I'm, oh my gosh, you know, and I was a children's librarian. So it's not like there's a ton of money in that either. And it was finally when it came about, when the decision finally decided it was time, several things happened all at once. And I share with people that when you are on the path that is the right one for you, whatever that path is, this clarity will appear. And if you had said that to me before this happened in my own life, I would have said, yeah, right, yeah, sure. But it did in that it was the trip to Belize that solidified the decision. I went to Belize and I was on a snorkeling excursion, and I was talking to someone about being a storyteller, because at that point, by 2005, I had been doing a lot of storytelling outside of the library, at other libraries and schools and different events, and I had gotten so busy that that's why I finally had to make the decision. That summer, I had something like 50 performances in 10 weeks, and I was still trying to work full time. And it was just crazy. It was just complete insanity. And as I was telling this young man about being a storyteller, he said, "You're the first one I've ever met. That's so fascinating." And we just kept talking, and he kept saying, "My country, we have so many stories here, but we have this huge problem with literacy. It's dropped by something like 40% in 15 years' time." And there were several factors as to why. Mm-hmm. And he said, "I just think you have the skill set needed. I just think you could make a difference here. I really believe that. I really do." And I was listening to him, and we're having this conversation, and I'm allowing it to roll around in my brain. And when I came home, he and I continued to email each other, and I just kept thinking about it, and I thought, yeah, I need to just do this. There is something out there in the world that maybe I could make a positive impact, and I just need to trust that I need to do it. And the other final sort of piece that freed me was my boss, Ellen Noel, at the time, and she sat down with me at the library, and she said, "You've got to fly. You have got to trust it, and you just have to fly. You've been doing this work for years, and you've got a gift. And if you don't take this risk, you're going to kick yourself. You're going to, later on, you're going to ask, why didn't I just leap?" And it was really with her blessing because I was thinking, oh my gosh, I don't want to let Ella down. I don't want, if I leave the library, I'm letting her down, and I'm letting the children and the community down, the parents. And I sat down with a lot of the parents and the children and really asked them what they thought. And all of them said, go for it. Really go for it and share your gift. Share this with
Crowdsource
other people.
decision.
It was just wonderful. I mean, they were so
Great.
supportive. I could not have asked for. And my family, my mother and my brother, thought it was pretty crazy. But they said, if it makes you happy, just do it. I mean, just try. What's the worst thing that could happen? Just do it. And then everything came together within 30 days. I had left my job. I put my house up for sale. And before the sign was even in the yard, the realtor called the night before the sign was in my yard and said, there's a man with five children who's interested in your house. Is that okay with you? Can he come by tonight and see it? And the crazy part about that, well, it's not so crazy. You all understand. I had put an intention out to the universe. And my intention was, at that point I was single and I had two dogs and I lived in a relatively large Victorian twin home. And I said, I want this to be filled with a family that can really use this house, really utilize it. And lo and behold, that's the phone call, a man with five children. And he came to see the house, and in 45 minutes it was sold, and 17 days later was closing, and I moved out. And that very same month, that's when I started the project in Belize and started going back and forth and traveling to all these villages, and everything somehow fell into place.
Wow, what a tremendous story. You know, one of the things I want to explore a little more is, as you've been sharing, it what strikes me is that your work is really as much about listening as it is about story listening, as it is about storytelling, and as much about learning as it is about teaching. And so, you know, it would be great to have you talk a little bit more about your work in the villages of Belize and how you found the stories that you wanted to help preserve. Like, how did you decide, you know, which stories were really worth keeping, and what was the process of preservation, so to speak, that you found?
Okay. Traveling to the different villages, there were certain stories that I kept hearing over and over, no matter what region of the country I was in. And it was really through what the people, the indigenous people of Belize, were telling me which ones they felt were really important. So those were the ones that I embraced as well, and saw the, they have incredible lessons. One of those, Tata Duende, who's the protector of the rainforest. And that's a mestizo story, and it's not only from Belize, it's all over Central America, it's through South America as well. There's Duende stories from all over. And the Duende story is also connected to the Maya, and the Maya, they call him Alush. And he's a short man. He's, well, different versions, he's different sizes, but between 1 foot and 3 feet tall. And his feet, the Duende's feet, are twisted around backwards, and he has no thumbs. And yet he's an excellent guitar player. I always found that kind of humorous, that he had no thumbs, but he's an excellent guitar player. And he likes to braid the hair of the horses, and he's very protective of the animals and the plants in both the Maya, the Alush stories, and the Tata Duende stories. And the more I was hearing these, people would share stories about how the chicle farmers who get the chicle from the trees, which makes gum, that's what used to make chewing gum, they would just tell these stories about if they were taking too much from the trees, that Duende would come and he would take things and move them around. And I kept hearing more and more of these stories everywhere I traveled from different people, and realizing not only was the story so universal within that country, but then it was, as I started to learn more throughout Central and South America, and then the environmental impact is so important. And that's one thing in Belize that's been really wonderful, is there, even their government has done a good job of preserving the environment and realizing how important the environment is. And so that was a story that became really important. And then going to some of the city schools in Belize City and seeing that littering and pollution was a big problem in the city, that story is such a great teaching tool to honor the environment. Whether you're out in the rainforest or in a city, it ties everything together. And it was also through what the people would tell me, you know, which stories, a lot of listening, as you said, there was a lot of listening to the people. And a lot of, for me, it was asking the question, what is it you need? How can I best serve you it wasn't at all about bringing an agenda from the outside in. What I learned really quickly in doing the project was a lot of people have really good intentions, but they don't ask enough what the people really need. And the way the project evolved in using the Indigenous stories was learning that these stories had actually been banned from being shared in the schools.
Really?
And they're such an amazing teaching tool. And they had been banned. There were several reasons. One, many of the schools are religiously based. So some of the religious schools felt like these stories were heresy or they were somehow against God, but they didn't really know the stories. And if they had truly, my feeling is if they had truly read the stories, they would see the incredible positive power in the story, that these stories, they contain really good life lessons, really positive life lessons, and things like respecting each other, respecting the environment, honoring your partner. If you're in a relationship and it's your contract to be faithful to each other, well, then honor that. And a lot of the stories speak to those types of things. So they were banned because, I guess, of the fear. And then I later learned that they were banned from telling because of the power. Stories hold huge power. And if you want to suppress a culture, take their stories. Mm-hmm. If you take their stories, you often take their power. And that was another sad sort of reality to some of what was happening there.
And who were you listening to these stories from? Was it the elders of the villages or the children or the...
Everyone. Okay. It was everyone. It was a mix. There were teachers who were in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. There were people in their 70s and 80s. There were, I'd be on a bus and I would ask, hey, do you know anything about Tata Duende? Or can you tell me something about... Another big one is Ishtabai. Ishtabai is a shapeshifter. She's gorgeous during the day, this beautiful woman during the day. And at night, she can transform into a serpent-like monster. And there's several reasons, there's several different variations on the story. Some say that one of the messages and lessons in the story is to encourage children to stay home at night, to not go out and be wandering around the villages at night, or Ishtabai might come and get you. Another one is about, and they have a much different relationship to the stories. Like here we hear that, we think, oh my gosh, how awful would you tell that to a child? That's just terrible. But there, the stories, especially in the villages, are still such a part of daily life that the children aren't afraid of them. It's just, you talk about it. And yeah, you know, if you go out at midnight, we shouldn't be outside at midnight anyway, Ishtabai might come and get you. And they're very matter of fact about it. It's not the same kind of, I shared some of those stories at a school in Pennsylvania. They had asked me to share stories, and the expressions on the children's and teachers' faces, because it wasn't part of their culture, I learned very quickly that that sometimes stories don't completely cross a cultural boundary, and you have to be very careful to give the backstory first. Mm-hmm. Don't just launch into it.
Context is everything.
Context is everything. You might scare someone needlessly. And that's why I share the Tata Duende stories, because protecting the environment, this is very universal, and they're not really scary, and we can all relate to them.
I think that's great, because you've shared stories, you know, in Paris, in Italy, in Sweden, all over the United States, and, you know, Central America. And I think that there is a lot. I mean, there is a certain, you know, some things that don't cross over, but there's also just such a universality to the theme.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's
yeah, and that the definitely there is universality in the stories, which is really great. It's more the when a story is, I would say when they're more perhaps abrupt, mm-hmm. or there's mm-hmm. a certain what some might perceive as a violence to the story.
Yes.
And I don't necessarily mean violence like coming to fisticuffs. I mean more like, you know, Ishtabai transform into a monster. And one of the stories is she'll steal the children at night. Well, if you don't have, like you're saying, the cultural context, that can just scare the bejeebies out of you even more than it would if it was something you were familiar with, the familiarity. But the universality of stories is so true. I speak to that all the time. And the same stories crop up all over the world, because at the end of the day, we're all human beings and we have similar fears and dreams and hopes. And that human condition is so similar, no matter what we look like on the outside or what our government or religion is.
You go,
Interesting.
there you go. And it's true. Like, I mean, I was, you know, we've just in this country finished an election that had a lot of stories around it leading up to in the camp, and not all of them, I mean, many of them, I think, were negative stories, and how, you know, this idea that we're all storytellers in one shape or form or the other, and it's important to be more conscious, I guess, of the stories we choose to tell. And that's where, you know, people like you really play a role in being that lens and shining a light on the healing stories and the, you know, the empowering stories.
Absolutely. Can I share a short story? Because that's a perfect segue into about a less than 5 minute story from Nigeria that speaks exactly to what you're saying. Would
far
that
be
be
it
okay?
From me to stand in the way of a good story.
Would it be okay? Okay.
Absolutely.
So this, it's called The Greatest Gift, and it's one of my favorite stories to share, and it comes from Nigeria. And so there is Chief Oba, and he calls his favorite servant in to have a consultation with him. And he says, I want you to go on a journey, and I want you to discover the greatest gift that has been given to human beings. Are you willing to go on this journey? And his servant says, yes, yes, anything that you desire, I'm happy to do it for you. So he heads out, and he walks across the great savanna, and he speaks to the men that are hunting the animals and the women collecting the fruits from the trees. He even talks to the animals, but he has not discovered the greatest gift that has been given. So he hikes up the top of the tallest mountain, sits at the top, and he meditates, and he listens to the wind, and he listens to the birds, but he has still not discovered the greatest gift. So he hikes down the other side, across another savanna, all the way to the river, and he speaks to the men who are casting out their fishing nets and the women doing their laundry on the bank side. And then he finally discovers it, the greatest gift given to humans. And with a happy heart, he runs back across the savanna, up the mountain, down the other side, bursting into the home of the chief. And the chief greets him and he says, my goodness, what is it? What have you discovered? He says, the greatest gift that has been given to people is the tongue. And the chief looks at him and he says, the tongue? He says, yes, with the tongue, we can speak words of kindness and words of hope. We can speak words of friendship and create relationships between each other. We can speak words of love, and we can work our way into someone's heart and live there forever. We can create peace between people, and that peace extends beyond nations. And the young, they do not have to go off and fight. And the elders, they can share their story with the next generation. And the chief is very pleased with this, and he asks the servant if he's willing to go out on another journey to discover the most negative thing, the most awful thing that has been given to people. And the servant agrees. So once again, he walks out across the great savanna, speaking to the men hunting the animals, women collecting the fruit from the trees, and he even speaks to the animals themselves, but he has not discovered the most negative thing given. So once again, he hikes to the top of the tallest mountain, and he meditates, and he listens to the birds and the wind, but he has not discovered the most negative thing. So he hikes down the other side across the next savanna all the way to the river, and he speaks to the men casting out their fishing nets, the women doing laundry on the bank side, and he finally discovers it, the most negative thing given to people. He makes his way back across the savanna, up the mountain, down the other side, all the way back to the home of the chief. And the chief greets him and brings him into the home. And he says, my gosh, you look so sad. What is it? What have you discovered? And with a heavy heart, the servant replies, the most negative thing given to people is the tongue. And the chief looks at him with some confusion. He says, yes, with the tongue, some people speak words of hatred and words of gossip and lies. And sometimes they break someone's heart into so many pieces it might never be repaired. And sometimes that hatred, it grows, and there are fights between people, and the fighting escalates, and then there's war. And some of the young may go off and fight, and some of them die. And the elders, they can't share their story. They sit and they cry. And the chief looks at him and he says, but I'm really confused. How can it be that the tongue is both the most positive gift and the most negative all at the same time? And the servant stops and he thinks for a moment. And then he realizes, because we are not only given a tongue, we are given a mind with which we can choose how we use the tongue. Positive or negative, it's up to each one of us to decide.
Wow, that is beautiful, and you have such a gift Thank you for
Thanks.
sharing that and
Thank
letting
you.
us
It's
experience.
really important. It's just so important. I tell that story to all age audiences because often we do not truly realize the power of the words that we say. And the power, not only thinking, I do a lot of anti-bullying work. That's a personal thing because I was bullied really badly until I was about 13 years old and I discovered theater, and that was sort of an outlet for me to discover another side of myself and a gift I had that I didn't know I possessed and use that to combat. But in bullying, the bullies often do not realize how deep what they say and do goes. And part of the goal I have in the work I do with that is having compassion for both sides, because on the opposite side, many people do not realize how hurt not only children, but people who bully others are themselves. Hurt people hurt people. And having that compassion for both sides. And often when you get a group together and you start speaking about the depth of the power of those words that are used on both sides, there can be such incredible breakthroughs and building those bridges between both sides because of the power of words.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that, I think, is something that we're all getting from your words. It's just that deep vein of empathy that runs through it, and the ability to really, put yourself not in a, kind of in a, from the intellectual standpoint, like put yourself in someone's shoes, but to really feel their pain, feel their joys is really what
Exactly.
lies at the beating heart of storytelling. And, one of the other things that, and this is, feels like it can feel like a tangent, but I think it is also part of the core of what you do. And then we should maybe open to Q&A,
Sure.
so that other people can chime in here with their questions and comments. But there's an intriguing element of fun in your work. The bubble blowing, the free hugs, the big wheels races. And I just, if you could comment on what role do laughter, joy, and the absurd play in the scheme of your life and work?
Huge, because that was another journey. So my childhood, and I'll say it in one sentence, I grew up with a suicidal father who tried to kill himself 5 times and died when I was 22, and a brother who was alcoholic by the time he was 14 and just celebrated 20 years of sobriety this September, which is great. I'm so proud of my brother for the journey he's been on, and a mother who has an anxiety disorder. So that was my childhood. And when I left home at 18, it was a real conscious decision to pursue a completely different path. And really search out joy and search out those fun moments and share them. Because the realization happened early on and then just grew. It's really, really grown in the last maybe 8 years. But how much joy is contagious in a good way, and how joyful moments, they release all sorts of endorphins. So scientifically speaking, they're good for your health. And when those joyful moments happen, how much they elevated me in a personal way, and then in sharing them, having so many people respond, how much what seems like such a tiny little moment, the huge impact that it can have on people. Those bubbles on the subway and handing out these little bottles of bubbles to strangers and having people talk about how much better they felt after such a small, tiny little thing. And it changed the energy on the entire subway, which was really, really fun to do. I encourage everyone to, you can buy little bottles of bubbles. There's lots of places you can get them. And I encourage you to just share them with people and watch the smiles that happen later. And they do. And the free hugs kind of grew out of that at the same time. I'd heard about it when I lived in New York City and did a free hug event with a group of friends that invited me, and was hooked from the very first moment because in that short video, we are so desperate to connect with each other. And when we hug, we're also releasing endorphins. And it literally makes us feel better when we hug another person. And I often joke that a hug is kind of like Wonder Woman's lasso of truth. And people share these incredible intimate details of their lives. I've had people share, there was a gentleman in New York that he watched us for a good 20 minutes. you'd come over and ask a couple questions. Why are you doing this? What's your agenda? What's your hidden agenda? I said, there's no hidden agenda. It's not connected to anything other than making someone smile and making someone feel just a little bit better. And he finally approached and said, this is so far out of my comfort zone, but I really do need a hug right now. And I said, sure. So I hugged him, and as I'm hugging him, and he felt like a rock, like cardboard at the beginning, and then he relaxed and he whispered into my ear, I needed this so much. I just lost my job on Wall Street, and I have no idea how I'm going to tell my wife.
Oh.
And those types of things, yeah, it's just like I couldn't believe this complete stranger shared something so personal. And it's happened everywhere I've done free hugs, no matter what country it's been in, people have shared these incredible moments. That autistic boy in Paris who just, for whatever reason in that moment, and I had no idea he was autistic, leaps up into my arms and is hugging me and full eye contact and laughter. And then his mother crying and realizing why when she shares with me that this boy was severely autistic. Mm. And she was just astounded that he would hug a complete stranger and look them in the eye. And her hugging me and whispering, you're special, you're special. And me realizing in that same moment how special she is too and how much she needs to hear that. And those moments, there's too many. I really want to write a book about that experience.
Yeah.
And I'm actually working on a show right now that's all free hug stories and speaking about that connection that happens across culture, across age. It's an amazing experience. I encourage everyone out there to try it. I now have a free hug sign taped in the back of my car window, and I've gotten free hugs on the highway. I've gotten drive-by free hugs, and it's really wonderful. It's a good thing.
I mean, definitely. That story, I remember watching the TED event talk that you did and just tearing up at the story of the little boy. And
it was so powerful. One of the most powerful still that I've ever received at this point. It's a beautiful moment. I'm grateful to have experienced it.
Yeah. Well, you know, Amit, are you on? All right.
Yeah, I'm on. I was just about to jump in here and
open it up.
To all our callers, if you would like to ask Kristen a question, go ahead and push *6, and we will enter you in the queue to ask a question. And I guess sort of while I have the mic here, I thought I might jump in as well. Kristen, thank you so much. The story that you were telling, you know, I had you on speakerphone, and as you were telling the story, I noticed my body language. I kept going closer and closer and closer to the phone, and I was completely drawn in. And so I can only imagine what it's like to hear you in person. And I love the story of the hugs and the bubbles. And you know, there's actually a group in New York out here that does a lot of those acts of kindness, giving out lemonade, giving out hugs. So I'm sure they'd love to have you join them at some point, lead out in an activity. But the question I had for you was, you know, there was mention on, I think I remember on one of the sites I saw that you had sold your house in 2005, and you had gone on to become this professional storyteller and to fund these some of these projects. And I guess, you know, from an internal perspective, how did you let go of that, you know, from a material sense? You know, how did you make that shift within to say, all right, I'm going to kind of give up some of the conventional way of approaching life and just go on this journey and see what happens?
That's a really good question, and the answer is going to sound so simple. But when the decision, when it finally was made, there really was no, oh my gosh, what am I doing? Or I'm letting go. It was, honest to goodness, the most liberating and freeing thing I've ever done. And I think part of the experience too was that helped with it was when I was traveling village to village in Belize. I did have a small room in Belize City where I had brought two huge Rubbermaid containers of books with me to do book donations to different schools. But most of what I brought with me, I had to carry on my back. And that will cure you of your attachment to stuff when you literally have to carry it from place to place. And then you realize how little you truly need to have to be happy and to survive. There were certain things, books have always been such a huge part of my life, and I gave away and donated most of my book collection. And I will say that that was a little bit, that there was a little connection there. But I do have, I've got probably 10 Rubbermaid containers that are filled with all the letters I ever received. I did not part with those. And the books that were the most important, but getting rid of the other things or letting go of them, it was just absolutely liberating. That's the only word I can use to say it. And I really think so hard now about anything at all that I purchase. I really think deeply about stuff. It's impact on myself, it's impact on the environment, because we don't, when people throw away things, they're not throwing it away. I wish everyone could go to a landfill. I saw one in Guatemala, and that was just absolutely life altering to see a huge landfill with one's own eyes. Well, I think also change one's relationship to things, to possessions.
I agree completely. I had a chance to visit a landfill out in India, and it's shocking and appalling on one level. And then knowing that some of the conditions that some of the folks that have to work in that environment and what the children are exposed to, so that definitely makes you think twice, three times, four times about what you're doing and the impact of even the small action. I'm gonna go ahead and turn it over to our next caller.
Hello, this is Susan Schaller from Berkeley. Thank you
Hi,
so
Susan.
much. Thank you so much. I was in tears a couple times. And thank you, Pavi and Amit, and everyone for joining. I wanted to give a gift to everyone when you were talking about the hugs, and it just reminded me of both hugs and storytelling. So in a sense, this is two gifts. I'm realizing one of the things you said that touched me, and I believe very, very strongly, is that the stories have to be from everyone. We have to be listening to everyone's stories. And a breakthrough in my work this year and updating my website and making it all about storytelling and community and inclusion, and your story about the greatest gift, that's what my focus is that the greatest gift is language, and the most horrible thing we can do is to exclude somebody and a whole group of people and their language, whether it's deaf people and sign languages around the world.
Oh, it looks like
Hello.
we just lost Susan. Susan, if you can jump back,
Oh, no.
we can have her continue. Sorry about that technical issue there. If next caller can jump on, and then we'll bring Susan right back.
This is Gayatri here. Hi, Kristen. It was so enlightening listening to you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you for all the stories. My question was, can you share your perspective on the dark side of life? How can you use that to empower yourself? So if you could just share your perspective on that.
Well, having come out of that and being completely honest with you, I've had three bouts of depression myself, personally. And what I can say is that being in that, it's really difficult when one is in it. What I would still do in the midst of that, in the midst of darkness, and dealing with all of the dark that we see, our the mainstream media is filled with dark, which is why I'm so grateful for you all existing, the Daily Good, and that's the first thing I look at. In the morning when I open up my email, I look for the Daily Good. I look at KarmaTube. I look at helpothers.org, and those are the things I focus on to realize there is equally an amount of good in the world and people choosing positive acts of kindness every single day, helping those around them. And it can be the smallest thing, just smiling at someone. I free hugged the mailman a couple weeks ago. And that was a progression because this mailman used to be really angry all the time. And he would throw the mail in the mailbox and just peel out on the street. And So it started with just smiling at him from the door and waving at him for months, months and months and months. And then one day I just happened to be out at the mailbox as he was coming, and I had my free hugs t-shirt on, and I said, "Hey, can I give you a free hug?" And he looked at me kind of astounded, and he said, I started to laugh, and he said, "Sure, that'd be great." And ever since that time, now every time he sees me, he is smiling and waving from up the street. So I would say the dark side of life and using it to empower, I think there's also strength in coming out of darkness. Mm-hmm. There's also the empathy for others in coming out of darkness when any of us have faced being in the dark ourselves, in being in sadness or anger, whatever that dark might be, or trauma, you know, some trauma that we may have experienced, whatever that might be. The positive piece is the empathy we can have for others who may be going through something similar, and to extend that empathy. And when we help others, the other thing is when we reach out, no matter what state of mind we're in, if we can get that energy, pull that energy together to reach out to someone else, we cannot help but feel better ourselves. It's mm-hmm. such a wonderful exchange that happens, mm-hmm. and it lifts us up as well as the other person. So I would say just using it that way and finding the strength that can be within that experience, there is a strength and a courage and a bravery that comes out of darkness as well. Mm-hmm. Does that answer it?
Yeah.
Does that help?
Yes. Thank you.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. Thank you for the question. That was a really good one.
I think we have Susan back up here on the queue. So thank you, Susan, for jumping back in.
Thank you. This is wonderful. The universe had a reason for me being muted and then coming back, because it has so much to do with the last question and answer. Because the gift I wanted to give was a hug vicariously. A hug that I received that I want to pass on to all of you, which it has to be in story form. And that is someone who was in terrible darkness. A woman I met who was one of the very few survivors of the Terezin concentration camp. Her name was Zuzka, which I found out was Czech for Susan. And I was so grateful for a tour she gave of the Jewish Museum in Prague, but I was too teared up to thank her, because I was so taken by her strength, but I was also so sad about so much that had happened in the concentration camp and in Prague to the Jews. So long story short, I found her again, and I gave her a great big huge hug and said, "Thank you so much. I couldn't thank you at the end of the tour because I was too choked up." And she gave me the strongest hug, and this is a little tiny 90-year-old woman who was one of the smallest people I had met, and it was seriously the strongest, physically strongest mm-hmm. hug I have ever received. And while she was hugging me, and I can't say this without crying, she said, "Be happy." She whispered in my ear. And this is from a survivor of a concentration camp who watched all of her family die. And I want to pass it on to you. Be happy that in the depths of darkness, in the midst of winter, there is an invincible summer. And I have only one thing to say in addition to what Kristen said, is that I don't think that the positive is equal to the negative. I think it's much, much greater. And that love is more powerful. And so I give a hug to all of you, whispering in your ear, "Be happy."
Thank you. That was beautiful, really beautiful. And I agree that love is definitely more powerful. When we come at life from that and really focus on it, it's just incredible the beautiful cross connections we can make between people. That was such a beautiful story you shared. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you, Susan, very much, and thank you for sharing your vulnerability with us as well.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, this is Anne from Hayward, East Bay, and I would like, just gratitude to everyone. But I would like to know if the speaker feels like there is any story that she has not heard.
Is there any story I have not yet heard?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes. Although they say to me, there's only six stories with variations, but I'm sure there's many
six?
Different.
What?
What are those six?
The six? Oh gosh, I don't even know.
Oh.
It's more of a joke where they say everything's based on the same six.
Yes,
sort
and
of
everything's
themes.
Been done. Yeah.
Right, and everything's been done, but I don't think so. I mean, everyone has their own story, their own life story to tell. And although there may be certain patterns, that the hero's journey, where someone goes out on either a literal journey or a figurative journey, and there are obstacles and there are challenges along the way, and there's usually some sort of a magic helper, whatever that might be, if it's a teacher, literally a teacher that someone has, or an elder, or a child, or some sort of free hug magic. And then there is the transformation that happens. And that's a universal theme in so many different stories, a pattern that occurs all over. But as everyone is unique, I'm sure there are stories that we have not yet heard. Or the weaving together of different elements of story to create something new, which is really exciting. Really exciting.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anne.
Hi, this is Jan from Connecticut calling. And Kristen, I'm hearing these wonderful stories which seem to be grounded in ages past or older culture. I'm wondering if you're picking up on stories that are now part of contemporary culture. Are we creating stories now?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely we are. And although that was much of the focus today in talking about the Belize work and in talking about just sharing something like The Greatest Gift, because those age-old stories that somehow stay with us is because they have such incredible power to them. But certainly there's contemporary stories that are being told, and the spoken word movement is huge right now. And a lot of what's happening are the personal narrative stories. I'm thinking also of Dave Isay's StoryCorps, and recording each other's stories, real life stories, are becoming just a huge part of mainstream culture, which is really exciting. And connecting us together that way. And then there's a lot of tellers that are working on taking things that are from the past and bringing them to the present. I'm thinking about a storyteller from Hungary named Csenga, and she's doing a really cool twist on the, maybe many of you might have heard of the moth, which started in New York and in Los Angeles, where people, there's a theme and it happens about once a month, and anyone is invited from the audience to share a 5-minute true story. And there's, you know, usually a theme. And what Csenga has done is she's created something called a myth off, M-Y-T-H, a myth off, where people take a myth and they twist it in any way that they feel is appropriate. And a lot of that is modernizing these ancient stories so that we can relate to them in the present day. And I'm really excited about some of the work that she's doing. And there are others out there who are doing similar kind of work.
Wonderful.
Does that answer it, Jan?
It does.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Hi, this is Lavanya from Pittsburgh. I've been enjoying so much the stories and like really liking the really enjoying really feeling so moved at the kind of stories you've shared, and I'm wondering, shouldn't adults be kind of reminded of these stories once in a while? It's I used to read and hear stories when I was a child and remember and love those stories. Even now they're a big part of my life, and I feel even as adults, we should be hearing and talking about more stories, which you probably don't. Can you comment on that? What do you think?
I think that's absolutely true. I don't think we ever outgrow stories. And the good news in the United States and really worldwide, I just returned from Edinburgh, Scotland, and their storytelling festival this year was focusing on the Grimm's stories, because the Grimm brothers' stories, it's the 200th anniversary. And this festival was all adults, and they were adults from, this was mostly European in the audience as well as in the tellers, and they were connecting all these different stories together. And there was also a gentleman who's from India, Peter Chand, who did a beautiful presentation about connecting the Grimm stories with Indian stories, because let's face it, the Grimms begged, borrowed, and stole from everyone, from cultures all over the world. But the good part about that is the bridging across of all these different cultures, because again, there's this universal knowledge contained in stories. And I think there is a trend now where there are festivals in the United States alone. There's, I think, almost 200 storytelling festivals a year. And they're really geared towards adult audiences, which is fantastic. In New York City alone, there's 22 events that are similar to the Moth, where people are sharing true personal stories. There's StoryCorps, which is recording people's stories. If you look at mainstream advertising, there are so many different companies now speaking about, you know, what's your story? And it's exciting. It's exciting, and there's a tiny bit of concern on my behalf. We spoke before about the power of words and the power of story. We've just seen it used in the election. You know, both sides are sharing stories. And I think the important thing is that we're really mindful of the stories that we share. I loved how Susan spoke about inclusion, that everyone's voice being heard is important. And I agree so much with that, not suppressing anyone's, but honoring the fact that we can all learn from each other's stories, and definitely there for adults too. So thank you for bringing that up, because it's important for people to realize that stories are for all ages.
Thank you.
While I have the mic again, I thought I'd steal the moment here and ask you another question, Kristen. It leads right from what you're saying, the power of storytelling, and sort of there's an art to it. And I guess if you were to give any sort of advice on to say a novice on the keys of telling a story, I would love to hear that.
Sure. From my perspective, the biggest thing is that the heart is truly in it. That if you're telling a story from another culture, that you honor that culture 100% when you're sharing the story, and make sure you share your passion about the story, and practice. not necessarily having to write down a story. Lots of the personal stories that I share, the personal narrative, I don't write them down, but I record them over and over and listen to them over and over again. I encourage people to practice in front of a mirror. And if you can entertain yourself, chances are you can probably entertain someone else. If you put yourself to sleep, you might want to practice a little bit more. that's just the key right there. Pacing of a story, allowing for pause, something I have to remind myself. Playing with a voice and having fun with that. Participation, I think it's really, really fantastic to include participation of some sort within the story to really pull the audience in. Whether that's call and response, having a song refrain that's in there, or even bringing people up on stage. When I work with youth audiences, I bring children up on stage to portray different parts in the story. It's really wonderful because there's a whole other type of learning that happens, and a deeper connection, I think, when they're that involved in the story. But I would say heart and honoring the culture are what are truly important. And not being afraid. The other thing is not being afraid to share the difficult stories. And I'm not saying to use the stage as a chair in a therapist's office, to make sure if you're sharing a difficult story that you've come to peace with it yourself before you share it, because you want your audience to feel comfortable hearing it. But I think sharing some of those difficult moments and perhaps the hope that comes out of those difficult moments, sharing that hope with someone else, I think is really important as well. I'll stop there. I'll just go on.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We have one last question, and then I'm going to turn it over to Bhavi to wrap things up. Audrey?
Hi, Kristen. This is Audrey. I've been noticing that a lot of what you shared, and I really loved your TED Talk about blowing bubbles on the subways in New York. And I've noticed that a lot of it is kind of about breaking down barriers between people. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could say a bit about, you know, your process in doing that and how, you know, a lot of times I notice I have a fear of kind of disrupting the status quo or disrupting kind of, or, you know, taking that step to reach out. So if you could talk a little bit about that.
I think in some of the process with breaking down barriers between people, and I'm really glad you brought that up because that is a huge thread between all the different work that I do and building those bridges between two, is trusting and knowing that people so deeply want to connect to each other. So if you're doing something, and it may be completely different from what I'm doing because it's unique to what your gifts have to offer, but if you're doing something from your heart in order to bring people together, that is felt. That is so easily felt by the other people that are in that space at that time. And when it's genuine and from your heart, it will build those connections and those barriers will fall down. Now, that doesn't mean that, for example, in doing free hugs, there's a lot of people who make fun of what I'm doing. And I'm okay with that because who knows what perspective or what lens they're seeing it through. I don't know their story. Maybe they had an awful, you know, maybe they were abused. Maybe they're really searching for themselves in that moment, and to try to extend to another person, that's too vulnerable. Some people can't hug for, you know, there's a myriad of reasons why, but if they smile, I'll always say something like, oh my gosh, a smile is great. That's awesome. Thank you so much for the smile. Or if they're in a group of people, hey, it's really awesome to hug each other too. That's great. Or whatever story, you know, let alone the free hugs, but in the stories that are being shared, I think the other important piece, and we had just talked about this, is honoring whatever it is you're sharing, really holding deep honor and respect for it, that is also felt by the people around you. I think that's why the project in Belize with the people themselves worked out so well, was they could truly, they tell me it time and again, every time they go, Kristen, you're so passionate about this. You honor our culture. You're so passionate. Thank you for your passion. Mm-hmm. And when it's genuine like that, it just opens up so many doors. So I would say just being genuine, and whatever gift it is you have to offer, trust in that gift and allow yourself to open it up to share it with others.
You know, Kristen, I love how your answers are proof of what you're saying, because even your answers are said with such conviction, such heart. And so appreciate that very much. I'm going to turn it to Pave to just kind of wrap things up, and then we will close with a minute of silence in gratitude for this call and for your time today.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you, Amit. Thank you, Kristen. This has been beautiful. It felt like, you know, it's felt like one long story and a continuing story that we're all excited to be a part of. And Kristen, especially, I mean, thinking and hearing, you know, a little bit more about your journey and getting a sense of where your gifts come from, it's really powerful. And just that, you know, flashback to your childhood and the deep unhappiness and challenges that you faced, and how, you know, there was a choice there, and you could have turned down a path that closed you down, hardened you, made you more bitter or fearful, and instead you took the other fork in the road, and the world is the richer and the brighter place for it. Thank you so much for that, and for really, you know, the alchemy of what you've done with your journey, and may it continue to spread far and wide. And thank you for making storytelling. It is a gift that you have, and yet you present it in a way that makes it so accessible and makes, you know, your audience feel like they can participate. And so may we all work on the stories we tell together. Much gratitude. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. You have no idea how big the smile is on my face right now.
Oh, and I do want to add another
thing. That was so beautiful. Thank you.
One thing that I do want to add is, you know, Vera, my husband and I get to help run Daily Good. And I don't know when I first started noticing that one of our most dedicated commenters on stories was Kristen. And, you know, she does take listening to stories seriously and the appreciation that you show and the deep kind of listening that you show for other people's stories is such an instrumental part of your gift. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
From all of us at Service Space.
Thank you.